What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
My name is Jared. We're joined here by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Austin.
Yo.
And Greg.
What's up?
And today we're doing a collab with one of the other Wisecrack podcasts called Blackstage, where Greg is with his friend Bradless, who we have here. Say what's up, Brad.
What's up, guys?
So, if you guys haven't heard Blackstage yet, Greg and Bradless talk about what it's like to be an LA comedian. They're always interviewing comedians and stuff like that. And I've been listening to their podcast. And I wanted to bring them into the fold and let you guys know about their podcast, let you guys get to know them.
Thanks for having us,
yeah,
man.
Absolutely, yeah, man.
This is great.
Appreciate this.
Yeah. So today we're talking about Django Unchained, the 2012 film written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, starring Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Leonardo DiCaprio. As always, let's go around and get some first impressions. What was it like watching the movie for the first time, and what was it like rewatching it? Austin, let's start with you.
Oh, shit, man. I don't even remember. I've seen this a bunch of times, and I helped do the research for the Earthling Cinema, Django Unchained, that Wisecrack did. So I also did like a deep dive reading of it, but I've seen it, God, like 10 times. I do remember, I think when I saw it, I had recently just seen 12 Years a Slave. It was right around the same time, right?
Yes.
And I think I saw it, I don't remember, because I don't even remember if I saw it in theaters. But I think I saw it around the same time as I saw that. And I remember just kind of like contrasting it with a prestige piece. And then, of course, this is just Tarantino's take on slavery, which is always going to be weird, right? It's always going to be different. And I dug it, man. I dug it. But I think it's the weird thing is I've enjoyed it more in subsequent viewings. And so I think it's actually like fantastic in what it's trying to do. I mean, it's got some things that I think are kind of weird and problematic. But in terms of doing something different and kind of pointing a different lens on a historical phenomenon, I think it's really fucking interesting. And then, of course, as it's just an interesting film. Jamie Foxx is fantastic. This is probably Leo's second best role ever after Wolf of Wall Street. So the performances are great. I love Christoph Waltz. And damn, Brunhilde, I love me some Gary Fox.
All right, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Greg, what about you?
It was weird. I haven't seen this movie in a long time. I remember the lead up for this movie. I was very excited. I went to the movies to see it. I was pumped. I loved it. But now watching it again after watching like all the slave movies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I felt like was like one of the like this is like the Spider-Man or like the Iron Man of like the comic book movies. And it started like, well, not started, but it jumped in between with all these other slave movies that came out. It made me appreciate this slave movie more than all the other slave movies.
Yeah.
But I dug all the performances, man. Jamie was great. Kerry Washington, beautiful, babe. Don Johnson. Leonardo DiCaprio. Everybody kicked ass, man.
Yeah.
Quentin is dope. I really enjoyed it. You know, certain parts of it, I'm like, okay, this is spaghetti Western, and it's like the black version of Inglourious Bastards. But I appreciate
it. Was that bad?
I don't think it was bad. I mean, you know, I've read so many stories where people like compare it as like, this is bullshit, we deserve it better. I'm like, blah, 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 blah. We've had enough slave movies, guys. We could have a comic book slave movie. But I enjoyed it for what it was. And Christoph, I mean, that first opening scene where they're just walking through like the desert, and then Christoph comes with that Dennis, and bow, he pops the head off, and I love that he's German too. It just says so much, you know what I mean? But yeah, I could talk about this movie forever. It's great. It's a great movie, and it lasts. It definitely does. It's Sam Jackson, stole the movie as he always does,
Steven. One of the best characters ever.
Yeah.
All right, Bradless, what about you?
Oh, man. When I was watching this in the theater, I was thinking, is this like the first time we've seen a spaghetti Western slave buddy cop?
It is a buddy cop.
It's a buddy cop movie, which I love when Tarantino does stuff like that because he takes like whatever the genre is and just he just mixes all the genres together. And you're thinking, oh, you're watching just this spaghetti Western was like, no, you're watching this adventure movie, then you're watching sort of like a heist type of caper thing, and then it turns into like a buddy cop, and then favorite slave movie. Jamie Foxx is portrayed the best slave since Kunta. I love, like he was like, yeah, the best. And what I love about it is that I read the build up to it was like, you know, when Tarantino comes out with a movie, Spike Lee's going to say something, and there's always going to be like a think piece, and Cornel West is going to write a 40-page article about some shit. So you're just like, I had to dissect all that. Of course, I read all that before I went into the movie. And then, and of course, you know, Tarantino's going to use the N-word and, you know, whatever. And when I was like, it still didn't stop me from laughing out loud. Because Tarantino always gets you. Like, in the beginning, I'm always like, I'm waiting for the joke that's going to get me into the movie. Because sometimes, like, in the beginning, when Christoph, at the end, when he gives the slaves the gun, he's like, you should shoot that guy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, this is when I was like, I'm in this fucking movie. He goes, and if any astronomic aficionados out there, the North Star is that way. And I'm just like, sold in. This is going to be funny.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I 100% agree. This is actually my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
Okay.
I love this one. I think it's so funny. I think that Leonardo DiCaprio should only do dark comedy roles.
because
he's amazing in Wolf of Wall Street. He's amazing in this movie. I 100% agree. I think Samuel Jackson, although he's had a lot of great roles, God, he kills in this. He's so funny.
Stole it.
And just the whole thing with them like painting his skin darker is so crazy and so funny. And yeah, I think that the weird thing is I'm not really a big Inglourious Basterds fan. I've only seen it once, I think, though. So I want to revisit it, but I just loved this movie. It was awesome seeing in the theaters. People were laughing. And it was like this real uncomfortable laugh, but like you could see that like at the beginning when they would make funnier parts of the movie that include the N-word, like at first people were like uncomfortable laughing, but like 30 minutes in, people were just letting loose.
I think
like
this is one of those movies that you have to see it a few times to kind of overcome the discomfort that culture rightly kind of ingrains in us, you know? And then I bet if you saw it with that same audience like a second time, it would be a different experience. I think people would be
I'm saying that now,
you know?
I'm saying that people were bought in like 30 minutes in into a 2-hour, 45-minute movie.
Yeah.
So it happened pretty quick. It is long, but...
So long.
It's probably the only 2-hour, 45-minute movie that never feels long to me. Well, that and Wolf of Wall Street, I guess. But I think these movies are super rewatchable. But yeah, I think this movie is funny. I love the violence. When Jamie Foxx is killing all the dudes at the end, it gets super awesome, hyper-violent Tarantino. It's basically everything I want from a Tarantino movie. And this is also the one that there's sometimes in Tarantino movies where I feel like the dialogue is getting just too wanky. Like, I'm like, okay, this scene can end. You know, it doesn't need to go on this long. But in this one, I never get bored. And I feel like these scenes are long, but really, really well constructed. And I think that actually one of the reasons why the scenes function so well is because it plays with this idea. And I think this is Austin's reading of the film that he did for Earthling Cinema. But it plays with this idea of authority and power in every scene, whether it's Jamie Foxx, how the other slaves in Candyland are reacting to his power, or Don Johnson reacting to his power, or even at the beginning with Christoph Waltz, initially you're like, well, why is he killing the sheriff? And then all of a sudden he's in power because he says, I have this warrant and I'm a bounty hunter. It's just this kind of stuff is happening all the time, and it makes it every scene super interesting, never gets too long-winded, and never boring. So I love this movie. Can't wait to talk about it with you guys. But first, let's go into a quick recap. And similar to last week's episode, I feel like I can get through this pretty quickly because it's another long movie where not a lot really happens in terms of big plot moments. But anyway. All right. So bounty hunter King Schultz enlists the help of a slave named Django to find and collect a bounty on the Brittle brothers. Once done, they decide to partner up through the winter and then find Django's wife, Brumhilda. After a lucrative winter, Schultz and Django trace Brumhilda to Candyland, the plantation owned by Calvin Candy. The two of them take on the persona of Mandingo fighter aficionados and attempt to trick Calvin into selling them Brumhilda along with a Mandingo fighter. Django and Schultz find Hildy, and they are on the brink of making a deal when they're made by Candy's house servant Steven and are forced to pay Candy at gunpoint. Right before they're about to leave, Schultz reflects on all the horrors he's seen at Candyland, and when prompted to shake Candy's hand, elects, instead, to kill him. Schultz is gunned down, and Django is captured and sold to a mining company. En route, Django tricks his couriers and rides back to Candyland, where he massacres the whole place, Steven included, and rescues Brumhilda. The fastest gun in the West rides off with his bride. End of movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, guys. By the way, guys, if you guys are hearing my voice and it sounds weird, I'm a little bit sick. I think Greg is coming down with something, too. So if we're sounding gross, we apologize.
Damn bastards.
Get you sick, Brett.
But so let's talk about slavery revenge fantasy. So he does this in a couple ways, and I think one of the most clever is the way that the violence against black people and the violence against white people is depicted in such a different manner. So whenever the white people are shot, especially at the end, it's classic Tarantino balls-to-the-wall violence. There's blood going everywhere. It's super cartoonish, basically. But then whenever the slaves are being brutalized, it's usually shown more realistically and often portrayed indirectly. So there's the part during the Mandingo fight where was it Samson or one of them is about to kill the other guy, and you see him like, what does he do, like squeeze out his eyes or something like that?
Yeah.
And then like we see gumballs fall on the ground. So it doesn't actually show us the horror. Or even the scene where D'Artagnan, the slave who gets ripped apart by the dogs. It's mostly portrayed through sound and reactions, and man, that part with it's just like a close up on Jamie Foxx as he just stays stoic.
So this is interesting because I've read some interesting criticisms of McQueen's 12 Years a Slave as sort of being like a romanticized exploitation on slavery, and I don't know how I think about it, but I do think that it's interesting to see the contrasting takes between his take and then Tarantino's take here. Is that instead of showing the kind of exploitative violence of slavery, which was obviously fucking horrible and had blood splattering and was grotesque, but instead of showing that and kind of just alluding to it, it has a different type of impact. But then what it does show is there's sort of like this cathartic experience of seeing like a white dude's blood splattered over a piece of cotton in the field, right? There's kind of something interesting about showing that aspect but hiding the other aspect.
I don't know about you guys, but I mean, since we're bringing up 12 Years a Slave, I found this movie way more cathartic than 12 Years a Slave. Do you guys agree?
I don't know. I mean, I felt like it's, you know, it's such a different story. You know, Django's a slave. He's been a slave his whole life, born into slavery. I forget, you know, Mustafa, whoever. What's the guy's name? Always give him shit.
The guy who's the...
Ujica. Always give a guy. The dude that played this... The slave in 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah,
I forget his real name.
The English dude.
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Ujica.
That
sorry.
Sounds like an original slave.
But,
come here, Uji.
I mean, you know, he was a bougie dude that, you know, wasn't trying to help people. And his story, how he got bonded into slavery, you know, it's a completely...
Django's like a working class slave? He's a slave of the
pretty
people?
Much. Pretty much. And I mean, it told that story. And I think 12 Years told its own story. But I definitely prefer Django over 12 Years.
It's more fun to watch, definitely.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Another thing is that one of the things I've been heard criticized 12 Years a Slave is that doesn't he only make it out in the end because Brad Pitt's character basically like alerts the proper authorities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this movie, one of the most cathartic scenes is seeing Django, who is not a bougie guy, who is just a slave, outsmart the Australians.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just that he's using his guns and he's the fastest gun in the West and he's a badass, but it's also that he's able to outsmart these, you know, like hickish Australian white guys.
Yeah.
Which is
But the one thing you could say is that it's still Christoph Waltz's character, Dr. Schultz, that he sacrifices himself at the end, right? For Django in a way. So it's, there's kind of like this weird, and again, this is just another thing that I've read where it's kind of like, well, is kind of Christoph Waltz the Jesus figure that dies so that Django can be free?
Wait, why is it a sacrifice? I felt like they could have just walked out of there. He could have just shook his hand and walked out of there.
That's where I had like a little take on it where I'm not as smart as you guys. You guys graduated
Please.
College.
Come Stop. On, man. Please. But, Stop.
My take was like, he abhors slavery, right? All that stuff. I think he has a code of politeness that's kind of like subtle, like in the beginning of the movie, where he's like, he's unfailing. Like, there's like, you will be, there's a certain way to talk to people, you know, like when he's talking to the slave and the Speck brothers, like, don't talk to him. It's like what? Like that, like a human being. Like, he has this, like, I'm a human being, you're a human being, no matter what. When they go into the bar and Django has the hat on the table and he has the two drinks and he's just like, well, like a polite, like, no hats. Like, he didn't say it, but it's like, no hats on the table. You know, like, this is,
yeah,
this out. And then he can't abide by someone being so rude and nasty and on top of that being a slave owner. I think it's, of course, he did the sacrifice, but also it's like, I'm not going to shake this fucking rude guy's hand also. Mm. I think that, I don't know, that's my take about, like.
Yeah. No.
There are a couple of really interesting things with that. I think one is that he's almost like, because, you know, the idea of slavery is that black bodies are dehumanized because they're uncivil and, so they kind of like deserve their lot because that's unnatural. And then the white people, they're the ones who are supposed to be the natural and civil. But Dr. Schultz comes in and he's the foil to that because he's like, no, actually, I'm the one who's really civil and I'm the white dude. Mm. But I'm the real kind of like I'm the real sort of like expression, let's say, of civility and of kindness and of somebody who has like a good ethical bearing or something.
Fairness.
Like that.
Fairness. You know, like he's fair.
Yeah, exactly. He's
the German
fair.
Is yeah. fair. Yeah.
It's almost like a.
That's why I loved it.
Well, it's also like a slight apology for Inglorious because, Inglorious, we shit on the Germans. Yeah, now the German is going to come and pass judgment on America.
Yeah, yeah.
This is before, 100 years from now, guys. This is your problem.
Right? which is so beautiful. I know, I've done comedy with Jim Jefferies, who's an Australian comedian, and his views on America. Coming from Australia, and Australia having their history and everything, and talking about all the shit that America is right now, it's pretty beautiful hearing somebody from the outside that's like fearless and ballless talk shit about this country. And I do like that aspect of Waltz, you know, how he's like slavery, and how he just treats everybody
as the
same.
That's how I feel that Tarantino wrote it. Like he wrote it like, if we were all to go back in time, we were like in a little box and we can't touch anything, but we could just see what's happening in slavery. Mm. Like, we'll be appalled. We'll be like all the sad things, but we'll also find it like absurd on its face, like the absurdity of slavery. I think when you get to the cartoonish violence of him killing the white people and the cartoonish way white people die in this movie, it's absurd, right? Mm. So it's like slavery is also absurd. I think it's like a comment on that. That's why you show like the subtleties of like when the slaves get like brutalized, but you're gonna show like a cartoon nature of the white people again because it's all a cartoon.
Yeah,
it's like it's silly on its face.
One of the things back to what Austin was talking about, you were talking about how civil Schultz is. There's one part of the movie that I found really interesting. This is right before he's about to kill Candy, and he's like stewing away in the chair, thinking about D'Artagnan getting ripped up by the dogs.
Beethoven.
And yes.
Yeah.
There's a woman playing Beethoven on the harp, and he's like, stop playing Beethoven.
Yes.
And I love this because, super interesting because, of course, he's a German. He probably reveres Beethoven as, you know, one of the greatest musicians of all times. And to have someone as just lowly as a slave owner appropriating his culture's music about, you know, and Beethoven, you know, literally sings to God or whatever you want to say. Was a really interesting part. And then that also works with just Calvin Candy, Leonardo DiCaprio's character. I mean, shit, I wasn't going to get to this later, but let's get to it now. I love the nuances of his performance, like, because he's like the hick trying to be cultured.
Right.
He's the way he moves his hands when he talks. He should have won the Oscar for this. I mean, just like he's got all those rings on his fingers. He's supposed to be like, and you know, just the way that he plays with his fork and tries to like, and he like, he puts his pinky up when he eats because he thinks he's so civil and so like, yeah. And
he's
then,
a nigga.
I love that line.
He's a nigga.
He says Wunderbar. He says it wrong. He's got eyeliner on. And I just love how this goes even more to the point of, like, it's that much worse to see somebody as gross as a slave owner trying to put this cultural lens on it, like he's a cultured
individual. It's also important to think, too, that in the 1800s, Germany and kind of like the Nordic idea, before like the World War II Aryan dominance shit, Germany was viewed as kind of like the, by a lot of like German philosophers, as like the most advanced country in the European West. Like they kind of thought that, oh yeah, like this is the end of history. Hegel wrote about this, you know, obviously Nietzsche wrote about this. They thought that they kind of had their shit together and they had it figured out, and they did in so many ways. They were the pinnacle of art. I mean, look at Goethe and, you know, German romanticism, German poetry. They kind of had their shit figured out. So you get this dude who speaks better English as his second language than the motherfuckers that he's with in America, where it's their first language. He understands justice. Like, he is wealthy. He's got money. He's got his shit together. He is like a better version of the human than these people who are supposedly superior. And he's kind of just showing them, no, motherfuckers, you're not.
Yeah, when he's like, oh, I like to have a parlay. And he's like, speak English. Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's my second. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So more to what Austin briefly alluded to, I wanted to talk, just get these out of the way, some of the other visual metaphors of revenge being wreaked upon white slavers. So there's when Don Johnson's character gets killed, there's like blood that splashes on the white horse. And then there's the shot that Austin just alluded to with when the third brittle brother is shot. There's blood all over the cotton. And then I think you can maybe make the argument that Django shooting the snowman is a stand-in for a white person. But yeah, I love this. To me, it seems like the idea of white supremacy is like being murdered. Essentially, right. You know, that's like kind of what the slave revenge fantasy is doing here.
Totally. Especially that.
Yeah, I mean, that's not subtle, you know.
Yeah, and then there's
that white horse. Thing. I mean, yeah.
And there's one other detail.
Not at all.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
There's one other detail I wanted to get your thoughts on, Austin, which is the second or the first brittle brother. He's quoting the Bible as he gets ready to whip one of the slaves named Jody, and Django shoots him through a Bible page that's like taped to his shirt. What did you think of that?
I mean, I think that that's, to me, that's really powerful, because the Bible was used to justify the horrors of slavery, right? The idea of the mark of Cain was used to say that black people bore the mark of Cain. And for people who remember, Cain and Abel were the brothers of Adam and Eve, and Cain killed Abel and then was given this mark. Well, in a lot of interpretation at the time, when like you had bullshit race science and bullshit religious justifications for kind of creating these asymmetries, that was one of the things that was used, is the Bible. So it's kind of like, I'm going to use God to justify, again, my position as being the civil, natural, and this is why we're okay and justified in oppressing the uncivil and the unnatural. And when he puts that bullet right through that fucking Bible, man, it's kind of like, fuck you and all your justification. I don't think it's necessarily we need to then go like, ah, Tarantino's like anti-religious and he hates God. No, no, no. It's he's saying, fuck you to the people who have appropriated something in this way. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, he went all the way around. That's why I appreciate Tarantino in this movie. He tried to knock down, I mean, it's so hard to knock down all the stereotypes and all the myths within slavery, but he pretty much, he punched a lot. He punched a lot. Especially, yeah. I love the Mandingo scene, too. I mean, that's so, people don't really talk about that much.
You mean Mandingo fighting? Or
The Mandingo fighting. And like that, and I love the correlation with that, with like the NFL, you know, like,
oh god,
yeah, let's, I mean, for real, these owners got these dudes killing themselves, pretty much.
They're at least making a good living.
That was a Chris Rock joke, wasn't it?
Yeah,
back in the day.
Is John Gruden candy in this metaphor?
All the coaches, except for like three of them. all the owners are white, right, in the NFL.
No, it's funny,
you know. And he got his liquor, and he got the women, you know, and that's what you get paid.
So speaking more to this point,
I did want to say, Jared, real quick, before we move on from like this bit, there's a bit where kind of going to the idea that Schultz is sacrificing himself. There's a bit where he says that I've never given anyone their freedom before, and this goes to a criticism of people like Adolf Reed, who has written an interesting article. He calls it like the James Brown theory of black liberation, I think is what it's called. But it's this idea of like it's all about individual agency as opposed to collective agency coming together. And he says that that kind of creates a false idea of what it means to actually struggle against institutional power or whatever. But yeah, so Schultz says, I've never given anyone their freedom before. I feel responsible. And I think that it's kind of this is one of those examples of how Schultz is really the one driving the story until Jamie Foxx gets his agency. And what is it that gives him his agency? It's when he gets a gun. And that's when he's able to like take power and take ownership of his agency. And that's when he comes into his own. And I get it, because at first he was dehumanized his entire life. So he didn't even believe that he could have that agency. And that Schultz kind of guides him and gives him the opportunities to realize, no, you are a free agent and you have power. And it's just symbolized through him getting a gun and being able to exact revenge so that he can get his girl, because he's Siegfried and his girl is Brunhilde. Right.
Right.
And so it's all framed through that myth, Wagner myth that Schultz tells. And so I think that was kind of something that was kind of worthwhile to think through, at least.
That makes me think about, so Greg brought up a kind of a contemporary lens to which to view this movie, and you mentioned the whole thing where Django gets his agency once he gets a gun, which I totally agree with. And that makes me think about when people like Killer Mike talk about why gun control can be particularly harmful for the black community,
totally,
and stuff
right.
like that. It made me think of that.
Do they do the scene? Does he get that loud purple outfit before he gets a gun, or after?
I think it's the same scene.
I think that's when he gets his agency. When he gets that loud.
When he gets to dress himself.
When he gets that loud.
When he gets that blue outfit.
Yeah, he's like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. It's
now I'm free, mother.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When he becomes a Crip.
He starts seawalking. Seawalking out of slavery.
The worst outfit ever.
It's Prince with a gun, man. I mean.
And that's one of my favorite funny scenes, too. Because I love when Tarantino does it. He makes the lowly smart as fuck, where you just want to like hang out with them, where the slave lady's talking to Django, and he goes, so you really is free? And he goes, yeah, yes I is. And he goes, so you chose that?
She chose to dress like that? Yeah,
and I was like, that is so hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like, that coming from a slave is fucking, like, you know what I'm saying? That's like great.
She's
like,
still joking him.
Yeah, she's still
joking. Is that the scene with Don Johnson's farm?
Yeah.
That's a weird fucking encounter with him and that woman, because Don Johnson's like, now he's not free like a white guy is free, but he's not a slave, so you got to treat him differently. And there's like this weird, I found that scene kind of funny.
Oh, no,
there's like this weird irony there of
the
him trying
to
explain to her how you're supposed to treat this dude.
Yeah. And then he's like, well, what's it? Treat him like Jimmy, the guy at the corner store.
Yeah.
So speaking of, you actually mentioned James Brown briefly, Austin. I want to hear what you guys think about. So during the film's shootout climax, we hear the playback, the classic James Brown song mashed up with Tupac's Untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think up until this point, it had been either kind of like Western music or kind of Western sounding music with blaxploitation kind of lyrics. What do you guys think about that?
I thought this was the most hip-hop period piece I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You can't do this movie without hip hop.
Why you say that?
Because, so like, when you're talking about Candy, when he's trying to put on a front, like how he's not really a high class guy.
Yeah, he's
right. A lot of hip hop is like putting on a front. You know, you like you fake it till you make it. You know what I'm saying? Those cars are not real in the video, basically. And also, the swagger of Django when he has that outfit on and the way he walks different, that's a hip hop swag. That's just like you're gonna see me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You feel me? And I also, this might be a hot take, but I feel like the way Leonardo DiCaprio's character is and Jamie Foxx's character, they're the two most hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Like I feel like they'll get along if there was no slavery. They'll be the dudes like in the rap battle. It's like, oh, let's go have a beer after the, you know what I'm saying? Like and watch 8 Mile together or some shit. Like they would go to shop at the same places. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I feel like their styles are like similar, except the power position is obviously what it is. But yeah, you can't do this movie without hip hop.
Especially without that James Brown song. Yeah. I mean, the big payback.
Do you think there's something about having like a white dude make this movie that allows him to be like removed from the seriousness so he's able to be more playful with it?
Yes.
Totally.
Like
Spike Lee couldn't do this movie.
Yeah, because like,
it's too deep.
Yeah, right? Because, I mean, if you look at, like, God, what was the Birth of a Nation film, and then obviously like 12 Years a Slave. I mean, they're all like super, super serious because obviously it's something that the person is emotionally invested in. Whereas this is kind of like because Tarantino's like a step removed, he's able to kind of play with all of these various
things. Yeah, the blowback, if a black director did this, it would probably still be we'd still be talking about like, why are you...
Mel Brooks made The Producer, you know, Springtime for Hitler, and he's Jewish, you know. I mean, this kind of goes to, I think that, you know, like when we talk about like, oh, only like directors or artists that, you know, they can only tell their own story or whatever. Like, I don't, you know, if someone wanted to tell a Jewish story, I wouldn't care what they look like as long as they tell a good story. I think this is a great example of how his distance from it actually created something that was not only interesting, but
that's why I'm surprised you have only seen Inglourious Bastards once.
Would you say
that again, Austin?
Oh, I'm sorry. I that's why I'm surprised you've only seen Inglourious Bastards once.
Yeah, it didn't
I feel
really
like you
work
kind of
for
find
me,
something really culturally interesting about
it. Yeah, it didn't really work for me, but I'd actually really be interested to see it again because I've only seen it once. Maybe it wasn't what I was expecting. And, you know, maybe it is something that's a little bit more personal for me. So maybe I kind of went in with like a kind of a slightly tinted lens. But, yeah, we should do that one soon on the pod.
No, that makes me think of when Spike Lee did that movie Chirac. And
I hated it.
Yeah, and a lot of people did. And a lot of people gave Spike flack about it. You know, him not being from Chicago. It's the whole thing.
Oh,
of,
I don't
you
care
know,
about that.
Yeah, but a lot of people were like, you're not from Chicago. That's why you can make it this like comic book jokey.
Yeah, but look
hokey.
At Widows with Steve McQueen. He's not even American.
Yeah. I haven't seen Widows yet.
It's
everybody
great.
Okay.
Well, shoot, he did 12 Years a Slave, and he's not American.
Well, yeah, 12 Years a Slave is not American, but I'm just saying if you're going to be talking to Spike Lee like that, I mean, at least he's American.
Yeah.
But whatever,
Sergio Leone's whole thing, right?
There's no examples of a black director doing like a Holocaust movie. You know?
No, we got to do our...
So, like, maybe I would want to see that and see what the reaction would be. But I don't think
that would be...
Or like a
Because, I mean,
person
there is something
like
about having
piece,
that
like
outsider's perspective.
Sorry, what are you saying, Austin?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. There was a delay. I think there's a delay.
Yeah, there is.
So, no, go ahead, man.
No, I'm saying I would love to see, like, Barry Jenkins do, like, something like The Golden Bowl or, like, a period piece or something, you know, where it's just... It is what it is. But that would just be...
This kind of goes to what you guys talk about on your podcast a lot about comedy and how so much of comedy is about identity these days. And I feel like maybe there's a lot of pressure that it, you know, now as Barry Jenkins is making his James Baldwin movie, right?
Oh, okay.
Is he? Wait, who's making the James Baldwin movie that's coming out at the end of the year? Isn't that...
There's a James Baldwin movie?
I know they just did a documentary.
Wait, I know there's a documentary.
Am I wrong? But what is the movie that Barry Jenkins...
I'm Not Your Negro?
No,
that's
not,
that was the documentary.
Yeah,
that was
I thought that was something else, but there is a Barry Jenkins movie coming out before the end of the year, right?
Okay.
Anyway,
I want to check it out.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, all right, let's move on. So, one thing, actually, my take with the whole hip-hop thing was very close to what Bradless said, and I was like, the way that hip-hop masculinity is like stylized kind of fake masculinity, in the same way this movie is a revenge fantasy that's stylized and fantasized, you know? So in the same way, like, there's even a Rick Ross song.
That's one of my favorite.
Thing, and, like, Rick Ross is the prototypical fake rapper. And so it's
CEO,
only...
correctional officer, guys.
Right.
Don't forget.
Hey, one of Miami's finest.
Don't forget.
Stop it.
Yeah, you're from Florida.
Anytime you listen to that guy, he's a correctional officer.
And a great a great rapper. Hey, I gotta go back home.
Correctional officer.
Stop it.
The epitome of a rat.
He's not a rat. He's a guy with a job.
Sorry.
Why do we hate people with jobs?
I don't hate people with jobs.
I don't hate people with jobs. I like Rick Ross.
If you're a CEO, you probably should be a rapper. that's all I'm saying.
Because you have access to all the real stories.
It's like, what's next? A cop rapping?
Oh, man. Probation officer rapping? Yeah. A judge? That'd be hilarious, by the way.
All right, so let's move on to the inspirations. I mean, this is a Tarantino movie, so you know that he's always stealing from all sorts of stuff. So there's spaghetti westerns. Greg already mentioned this earlier. It's actually a great article in Vulture magazine from 2015. They actually chronicle, at least they attempt to chronicle every reference in a Tarantino movie. And so I took some out that are from this movie. So the whole Mandingo fighting thing, there's actually a movie called Mandingo that came out in 1976. And that was his inspiration for the Mandingo fighting sequences.
I thought you were talking about
isn't
the porn.
Isn't there a porn star?
There is a porn star named Mandingo.
Never heard of him.
Okay.
Yeah. Never heard of him.
Yeah, right.
What are you guys talking about?
And then there's a movie called The White Buffalo, which is a 1977 movie starring Charles Bronson, and that's where he gets Django's glasses at the end.
Okay. Oh, I've seen. All right, yeah, I've seen that poster.
And then, of course, the theme song that plays at the beginning is the theme song to the original movie Django about a slave.
Oh, I thought it was Elvis. So it's not like Elvis singing. Django. I was like, why
it might
Elvis
be.
Singing?
I don't know. but anyway, the other thing about that spaghetti westerns that's all over this film is quick zooms, something that you don't really see in Hollywood movies these days, but they're all over spaghetti westerns. All right, so then the other one is blaxploitation stuff. So I think you can, I mean, Django's blue getup can be basically him like doing his own.
That's the
like,
that's the platform shoes with the fish in the
yeah.
In
and
the
Greg,
heels,
you run a show about
blaxploitation. Shout out to Blaxploitation.
Yeah,
check us out on Twitter, Blaxploitation.
Can you buy that? So that's a Mac reference. Yeah.
All right, and the last one is German mythology, which basically Austin already covered. And I'm actually curious as to I took a whole class on Wagner in college, and I don't really know how deep this goes, but basically Schultz tells Django the whole story of the ring cycle and how he's basically Siegfried and Brunhilde is Brunhilde. I've seen a couple of different articles try to liken other characters to the characters in the myth. The only one that I really buy, and I'm curious to hear what you think about this, Austin, is that in the last of the four operas, assuming that we're talking about the Wagner piece and not the previous ways that these legends were written. So there's kind of the evil god of the gods is a guy named Wotan, and he's defeated by Siegfried, ushering in Götterdämmerung, which is the twilight of the gods, which is the name of the last poem. And so this goes to this Nietzschean idea that Austin and I talk about a lot in this podcast about the death of God. Wagner and Nietzsche were homies at this time, much to what Austin was talking about earlier. And so here I'm wondering if we're meant to believe that when Django is, you know, riding off into the sunset with his girl and we have like Candyland is just rubble. Is it like a, in the same way, it's like basically Götterdämmerung, death of the gods was the Nietzschean like death of God, death of religion. Like we don't need God anymore. This is kind of a death of slavery moment.
Yeah, exactly. And then Jamie Foxx's character Django is the Übermensch or Zarathustra or something like that in Nietzsche's writings. You know, he is the strong individual with the agency. He's the Messiah. He's the Superman. He's the one who's able to slay the dragons in old mythological terms and to create the new world, rescue the princess, and then you kind of go do your thing for the rest of your life. But yeah, I think that's absolutely. I mean, Tarantino's going to put his twist on everything, right? Like he's doing a Manson movie right now, but it's not a Manson movie. It's just like a film about Hollywood while Manson shit was going on. So it's like anything that he does, he's going to put his own spin on. And he does the same thing with the Siegfried myth.
Wow.
So,
I didn't know he was doing
so yeah, I think that's there, but obviously it's twisted and contorted for his own purposes. So
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Really?
I can't wait,
man. I think it's
going to
be.
Wow.
Which
I will see anything that Tarantino ever made.
No, I think they're both like cops or something.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk about the best performance of this movie. Let's talk about Steven.
Oh, Sam.
Warriors, you don't think so?
I think so. No. You know what? I didn't know that a lot of slave owners couldn't read.
Oh.
I didn't know that.
They're still country as fuck.
Yeah, I didn't know that Steven was like a real thing where like those the slaves like ran like they did the books, they did the numbers. Like they taught, they were like the Aristotle like the of the fucking plantation, and then like these guys are just, you know.
Well, I think that was one of Tarantino's like best parts when I talk about how he really punched slavery in every form. I loved how he showed that, you know, slavery is white people taking advantage of over the slaves, the black slaves, but also how these white people didn't survive without these black slaves. You know, like how could they can only make money off of these people doing everything for them. But not only are they making the money off of them, they're wiping their ass, they're training their children, you know,
codependent.
Building their it became a codependency, and I mean you can still see that in America today too, like this weird hate love, I hate you but I love you, and you know this weird fucking relationship that is just blowing up in America right now.
One of the things that I find most interesting, there's a part So Django kills all the people in the plantation. All that's left is him and Steven. And Steven drops his walking cane as if he never needed it. That part, I'm always like, whoa. Like he was just playing this role, like he had to be the hobbling subservient.
He had to do what he had to do to get by.
Yeah.
But then I love the part where he tells Leonardo DiCaprio what's going on, and they're in the study together, and Steven is smoking on a pipe, and it's almost like they're equals.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, when it comes to authority.
Not even equals. It's like Steven's high because the way he sits on that chair.
Yeah.
I think he has a drink in his hand, right?
Yeah, or like in a pipe, yeah.
Yeah, the way his hand swirls the thing in his hand, it's like he's like Don Draper.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Just like, totally. You know, this is my meeting. You know what I'm saying? Like, I love that power dynamic, how it switched
it's
over.
Almost like he's like, son, I'm going to tell you what you did wrong. Or something like that. So I always thought that was interesting.
What's up with his blackface?
Why do you guys think they did that? Why did they make his skin darker?
I think the movie, I think it's shinier. I know they did it darken his skin. I feel like his skin was shinier, and I think all the scenes, especially towards the end, especially when he tells Leo what's going down, the scene's so dark. The room is dark. It's super dark, right? It's not lit.
No, I read that they like put him up with makeup, like made him like a couple shades darker.
I think Tarantino was watching Boondocks and he wanted to make Sam look as much as Uncle Rufus as he can possibly make him look. Because he looks so much like Uncle Rufus, man. Look at the hair, the skin.
The character is the lowest of the low, right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's...
But is he? But is he the lowest of the low? I don't know. I know a lot of dudes like that guy.
Well, he says the only thing that's lower is the black slaver, which is what Django plays.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about Steven is that he's kind of like, I think part of the reason he doesn't like Django is he's kind of like, listen, motherfucker, I have my own my strategy here, and you're coming in here and you're fucking up my game. I've got all this luxury. I'm actually the one kind of running this house. I'm playing this game just so that I can get by, but don't fuck with my power. Like, don't fuck with my thing that I've got going on here. And so there is something interesting going on there as well. It's kind of like, it's almost like what's the best strategy to deal with this? Whereas Django is kind of like the Ubermensch. He's going to go slay the dragon. He's going to get his girl back, and he's going to like expose the horrors of racism. And Samuel L. Jackson's kind of playing the game in order to get by.
Yeah. He's like,
it's almost like he's like he's leaning in, you know?
Yeah.
I've climbed to the top of this game. Do not come in and fuck it up.
It reminds me of the civil rights of, like, you know, it's always those people during the civil rights that you read about and see videos on. It's like, hey, man, nah, we don't need to do this. Come on, man. We got our own shit. Yeah. You know, why y'all going up, stirring up trouble and shit? But, you know, it's always that back and forth. But who's smart? I mean, it's not to say that Sam isn't smarter. He just saw, like, hey,
right?
I'm in this country and I don't think this shit's going to change. So I'm going to ride this wave.
Well, he plays DiCaprio too.
Yeah, of course.
Even when one of my favorite parts is like DiCaprio makes the lamest joke at the dinner table. He's like, I can't even deal with a week in Boston. And then Steven starts laughing like it's the funniest thing he's ever heard, like disrupting the dinner. And of course it just makes Calvin smile because he feels like he's so proud of himself for coming up with such a funny joke. But it is interesting how he's being kind of like Steven. Yeah, he is the real man of the house. That's why I think that cane is kind of like Votan's spear. The Votan's spear is the thing that is very important in the ring cycle. It's what gave him his power. And I feel like when he drops his cane, he's like, all right, my power's over.
Game's over.
Game's over.
Yeah.
You hear something interesting in like the contemporary debate in feminism too, right? Like there are some women who are going to be anti-capitalist and they're going to be opposed to it and they're going to struggle against the system. And then there are some women who are like, no, I'm just going to climb to the top of corporate power and I'm going to make my millions. And Samuel L. Jackson is like the lean-in feminist, and, you know, Django is like the revolutionary.
Yeah.
It's like change the system within instead of from without, basically, type of thing.
I mean, exactly.
Yeah. There's another part that I always found really funny about DiCaprio's character I just want to bring up.
Hold on, can I just piggyback on the Steven thing? I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
You think it's like how when black people, when we talk about how we have to have, I think Dave Chappelle had this joke where he goes, all black people are bilingual. They speak two languages. They speak English.
And they speak
job interview.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's like the level of job interview speak that Steven has is like Rosetta Stone level 7. You know what I'm saying? It's crazy code switch.
Yeah.
Where
I don't know. Double consciousness, W.E. Du Bois.
Right.
That exact idea.
W.E. Du Bois talks about that. Yeah.
I just want to throw that out there.
Deep code switching.
It's like super, like playing chess on that level is very good. It was very interesting to watch on the screen.
One of my favorite DiCaprio moments is after the Mandingo fight happens and the guy who did it, or the guy who won the fight, is about to go to his room, and DiCaprio says, "Now you get him a tall beer." And then he gives him the beer and then he looks right at the guy's eye and he says, "You enjoy that, boy. You earned it." Like he's so magnanimous, almost as if like it's a father telling a son, "See, with a little hard work, you too can live a life of dignity." But it's and then as soon as the fighter turns around and walks away, he just like downs the whole thing because it's like, "I just fucking killed a guy. My life is fucked now." You know,
I love the way beer is used in the movie.
Oh, the movie. Yeah.
I love the way beer is used, especially.
You're right. I didn't even look at it like that.
Yeah, because when they're in the bar and the attention to detail he has with the thing. And one of my favorite scenes is, it's like, I feel like when I watch him, it's like, oh yeah, I'm trying to see myself through Django. It's like, oh, he's experiencing new things. So when he takes that sip of beer and he makes that face and it's dribbling out, that's the first time he ever had a beer.
Yeah.
So that's the face you would make. You'd be like, it's like he doesn't know if he likes it or not, but he knows. People do this that are free.
Nobody likes beer the first time.
That's a great point you bring up, because when we see at the beginning when Schultz gives Django a beer, it's like two dudes just enjoying a beer.
Yeah.
Whereas when Leonardo DiCaprio gives him a beer, it's like basically like a guy giving his kid like his first juice box. Like, you enjoy that. You know, it's like dehumanizing. super interesting. All right, last thing I want to bring up is the whole thing with power. I kind of alluded to this earlier, as I'd mentioned that there are these times where so many of the scenes are built upon conflict stemming from how authority is created, subverted, and manipulated. So we have, like I mentioned earlier, the early bounty hunter scenes. Schultz is quickly currying favor with people by offering them money. Don Johnson's character doesn't give a shit who this guy is. Then when he says, "I have 5,000 things that might change your mind." And then he's like, "Well, come on and get yourself something cold to drink." Yeah, same thing happens with DiCaprio. And then with Django, this is happening all the time, and it's always really interesting. So there's the dynamic between him and the other slave on Don Johnson's plantation that you mentioned. The push and pull between him and the other Candyland slaves, between him and the other Candyman hired guns, between him and Steven. There's even Brumhilda coming from girl in a hot box to a comfort girl. And we already talked about Steven, how he's sitting in the chair smoking a pipe like they're equals, or maybe even, to Bradless's point, a superior. Yeah, is there anything else that you wanted to bring up, Austin, before we go into the mailbag?
You mean just particularly about power?
Anything
in particular?
Anything really.
Well, the only thing I would say is there are some really fucking interesting think pieces out there. I mentioned the one by Adolf Reed Jr. He's a political theorist at the University of Pennsylvania. He's amazing as like just a political theorist who is thinking through issues of like black identity and class struggle and whatnot in all of his work. But he has an interesting take on this film that's critical. And he's also critical of other films kind of in the same type of genre, where he says it's about individual agency. And he thinks that kind of is damaging politically because it sort of diminishes, if you will, collective struggle and the importance of that. And there are all kinds of things. Like, there's one by Soyeka Diggs Colbert called Black Movements, Performance, and Cultural Politics. It's a book that talks about this film, where she says that this film is both once comforting and it's deceptive by offering the remedy of unfettered individualism and the idea of the individual, the person of power, the Ubermensch or the Superman or whatever. There's just some interesting fucking think pieces. And I think this is going to be one of those films that literally, when we look back 20 years from now, maybe even 50 years from now, over Tarantino's corpus, we say this might be his most important film. Because I do think that it's doing something that this one, I mean, I think Inglourious Basterds is fantastic. Obviously, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs were amazing. And I think cinephiles will still love them. But in terms of cultural impact, I think that those two films are going to be the ones that stand out from his.
Yeah.
Nice. Right. What year did this come out?
2012.
2012?
Yeah.
So
this is right around 12 years ago.
This is like also like middle Obama era.
This is what I was going to say. Like, perfect movie to drop this when the first black president
gets reelected.
Gets reelected, because it's like, okay, now can this movie drop 2010? You know?
Yeah.
2008 pre Obama getting in? Or is it like, no, this guy has four more years. We're going to do a movie about slave killer white people.
About, yeah, like fantasy, black identity, right. You know, revenge fantasy.
Right. Well, and I wonder if.
I mean, could you imagine if this film came out now, how much certain people would be flipping their shit, man?
I fucks with you. I was just thinking that right now. I fucks with you.
People will be going crazy.
No way.
There should
man.
Be a part two. Just Broomhilda Revenge or some shit. Hell no.
Well, whether or not people would freak out, I just feel like, you know, if someone said, like, what were the Obama years like? I'm like, Django Unchained, watch that. I feel like it's just like a good.
I wish.
It's like, oh, well, I mean, not like literally. No. But it's just a good cultural artifact for like what was changing at the time.
It's the Jekyll and Hyde of the Obama thing. Cause it's like you have 12 years of slave and then you have Django in the same time. You know what I'm saying? So you got the black president, but you still have this racist ass country at the same time. It's like this like dichotomy that's very interesting. So if you would, that's really cool. So if you had one of the movies I would describe the Obama era, if one of those, it would be Django.
One of them, it would be. I haven't put a lot of thought into it, but one of them would definitely be.
If you go, name five movies that give you the impression of these 8 years in America, Django's gonna be in the top 10, right?
Of Obama years?
Yeah, of the 8 years? As an appointment, it's like, correlate this movie to this specific time. I think Django is going to be up there.
I mean, look, you got like 100 years of John Wayne. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think on both sides, people want, well, not on both sides, but I think people wanted Obama to be more of a black president than he was. You know what I mean? I think
they want him to be Django.
I think some people wanted him to be Django.
You heard that,
but
Mitch McConnell? I'm sorry.
Are you saying that Obama was Steven?
No, I don't. I'm not saying.
Yes. I fucks with you, Austin.
I'm not saying.
Yes.
I'm not saying Obama was Steven, but he was nowhere near Django.
Right.
Oh, I'm gonna say.
Damn. He's Schultz. The German character.
He's not Schultz either. Not that ballsy.
No?
He would have been dead if he was Schultz.
He's so above the fray and fair and playing on a different level, but he's hamstrung by the rules.
I don't think
so. I think he is.
I don't think he was hamstrung by the rules either. He could have done.
Nah.
Done
all right,
more.
All right, all right. So we're gonna go into the mailbag. First, we're going to start off with our voicemails. You guys want to send us a voicemail with thoughts, comments, questions, it's 213-534-8807 or it's 21-ELFGUT-07.
Okay.
All right. ELFGUT. Okay. All right. Before we get into the mailbag, guys, I want to remind you got to check out Bradless and Greg's podcast, Blackstage. You want to give me a little pitch as to what you can expect?
Oh, man. Blackstage is a comedy podcast that's actually funny. We do interviews, but it's hilarious. We bring the funny. Me and Brad are comedians in L.A. We've been doing comedy for a long time. We know a lot of the funniest people in L.A., and we bring them on, and we talk about the struggles of being a comedian and a commie. We talk about everything, and we have, like, big-name comics, middle-stage comics, and you know, open-mic comics, and it's fun, and we just laugh and talk about the wildest shit. It's great.
It's a good hang. You'll enjoy listening to it. We don't get too nerdy about podcasts. We talk about everything, about comedy. We talk about everything, so you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, comedians love it. Regular people love it, and we talk about daily events, too. So just check it out. Blackstage with Bradless and Greg.
Cool. All right, going into the voicemails. First one is from Villain from the Discord. That's at wisecrackplus.com if you want to join. Go, Villain.
Hey, Wisecrack, Villain here. I'll skip all the compliments because I know you guys hate them so much. I wanted to talk about Mandy and the theme of metal that kind of runs through. I know you talked about it a little bit, but it's really, really a prevalent theme. You know, it starts in with roots of high fantasy and all of these other like sci-fi elements, kind of like metal. You know, the term heavy metal comes from the Soft Machine. Black Sabbath was really influenced by, you know, high fantasy stuff. And then at the end, we're into church burning and extremism, kind of like where extreme black metal is now. You've got the anime segments in the movie that are a reference or an homage to heavy metal, the show. You know, you've got the same kind of design aesthetic and iconography as that show did. And then you've got this whole, like, comic relief aspect. As the music and the violence and the gore and everything is escalating, You also have a sense that this is so ridiculous that comical. And that's kind of, like, even a metalhead can make fun of metal for being too over the top and, you know, kind of silly. And you can take it, just like the vodka scene, you can take metal seriously, like, on its face, or you can kind of take it tongue-in-cheek and enjoy it in that way, and both are very valid. Kind of like how you both enjoyed... how you both enjoyed Nick Cage's vodka scene. And I think even Mandy herself is kind of a metaphor for metal in some ways. You know, she laughs in the face of the Jesus freak and in the face of her destruction. She's kind of this driving force behind Red. And at the end, instead of blaring music and driving off into the two moons, he's with Mandy. He's, you know, realized this sort of extremism that is driving him. He's driving off with it.
All right, I'm just going to cut it off there. That was, yeah.
Dope. He was, yeah, he saw that.
You guys listen to metal?
No.
No, I never really listened to metal either. But I know I had some roommates that used to, and I know that a lot of it is like telling, like there's a band called like Epica or something. It's like they tell fantasy stories through metal. And yeah, I guess it's not entirely serious. I like this. I like Villain's comment a lot.
Yeah, I like his take.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, metal operates in terms of like myth making and myth telling. They're telling of a different vision, you know, and a lot of it, the like anti-Christian elements, like she talks about Mandy yelling in the face of the evangelicals or whatever they were, the cult. I thought that's really fucking interesting because, yeah, that metal music is like opposing itself to all of these other sort of status quo forces, and it's kind of trying to paint a different picture of the world. And I love the comment about the cartoons pertaining to, I don't remember if he said the name, but I think he was talking about Metalocalypse. Did you guys ever watch Metalocalypse?
Is that cartoon on Comedy Central?
That is, but he's talking about the movie Heavy Metal.
Oh, was he? Okay, yeah. I thought he... is it a cartoon?
I actually haven't seen it, but I know, like, the box art.
Yeah. With, it's like Fist of the North Star anime type.
It's like an 80s movie. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
80s Heavy Metal cartoon movie.
But I think even Metalocalypse is probably influenced by that.
Are you talking about, like, metal making fun of itself, like a Beavis and Butthead thing, like... metal could watch itself and make fun of itself type of thing?
Yeah, just that, like, there's a sense of, like a wry humor to metal in that they are kind of aware of their nerdiness or the over-the-top, like, kind of, like, aggressive nature. They're not actually as aggressive as they sound.
Oh, wow. Nah. They should tell people.
it is weird when you hear, like, that
they were nice guys, by the way.
They should let people know that.
I'm into biting heads off of poultry and sewing.
When you think about Nordic countries, that's where, like, all the hardest metal comes from. But those are, like, the nicest people.
Right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. All right, we got one more from Travis.
Hey, what's up? This is Travis from Nacogdoches, Texas. I'm calling about the Mandy podcast for Show Me the Meaning. One of the things I found most interesting was the Reagan quote. Maybe it was not talking about porn literally like Playboy or Hustler, but more of porn as in violence, how that Americans were obsessed with violence. I mean, look at the time this occurred after Vietnam, Korea, World War II. And so Americans were all obsessed with the porn as violence. It also layered into look how stylized the movie is and look at what was coming out at that time, the slasher film renaissance with Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. True. Maybe it's saying that we were so into normal porn of just shooting Nazis and the Viet Cong, but now we need more stylized porn. We needed more violence that was gruesome, bloody, inventive, and that now it's just continuing. We're so bored with the normal slash people's throats that now we need more inventive machetes and hand axes. Well, what do y'all think? But...
that was awesome, Travis. We got some good voicemails today.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
These dudes, what weed are you guys
smoking? Just think like an alternative timeline. If fucking Vietnam was never on TV and we never saw that live footage as a world that was exposed to that, do you think that we would be watching the same movies now? Like, I mean, humans are always fascinated with violence and we always want to, like, you know, art is always pushing things and showing us things that we wouldn't see. I mean, just look at fucking, like, medieval... like paintings of hell and shit like that. Like they're obviously exploitative or we would call them maybe exploitative, but I wonder, like we are fascinated by it and we do want to see it all. We want everything on display.
Well, I mean, we're talking about.
I think it would.
Yeah, I think so too. I think this country is just, you know, it's born in violence. Even without the wars, I mean, which adds to it. I mean, there's civil wars that everybody knows about. But you got a point with the Vietnam thing. I think everybody has this thing about blood and gore. And the Travis, I really think he hit the nail on the coffin with that voicemail, man. He had some really really good points.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but I think that Vietnam point is, I think before Vietnam, you had plausible deniability. Mm. You can say, like, you can hear the war stories from your dad. You know, my dad was in World War II. My uncle was in Korea. My grandfather was in. I hear the stories, and I got the newspaper, whatever. But now everyone has this little box in their living room, and you're gathered around it, and you can't deny what you're seeing now. So I think... yes and no, like the plausible deniability was taken away of, like, I don't have to see that, you know what I'm saying? That's over there, but now it's coming to you, and now that's in your house, and it's there, and just it's everywhere now. Like, you want it more. And does that make sense?
Yeah. It does. All right, now we're going to go into the emails. So send us an email at movies@wisecrack.co. This first one is from Sheriff. I think she says... this is Sheriff from Canada. I'm a big fan. I was listening to the Get Out episode of Show Me the Meaning, and I remember Jared and Austin saying that they were adherents to the auteur, or I think it was actually Jared and Ryan said they were adherents to the auteur theory. However, death of the author has been mentioned on numerous occasions on Show Me the Meaning. I've noticed in the last few years the death of the author theory has been used by many film commentators to dismiss the role of a film director in creating a movie and focus on the societal and cultural trends that shape the movie. I wanted to know if you guys have noticed this kind of commentary in your work. If so, what is your opinion of the usage of this death of the author? The reason for me asking this is I feel nowadays there is a tendency to strip a film director of any agency in the creative process and to dismiss his or her intentions altogether. My concern is that the death of the author is used nowadays, in my own view, as an ideological justification for treating filmmakers as nothing more than technicians who create movies as instructed to them by a studio akin to Hollywood's Golden Age. So, what do you guys think? Well, I can just go ahead and jump in. I think that, well, as far as this last thing that I'm assuming it's a she, that she said, maybe he said, is that ideological justification for treating filmmakers nothing more than technicians who create movies as instructed to them by a studio. I think that's happening, but it has nothing to do with the way that we interpret movies. I feel like that's done because these days the way to make a movie in Hollywood is like, you know, you got a superhero movie, just hire some guy who made an indie movie and he's just so happy to be there on set that he'll do whatever you want. And that's why all the Marvel movies are kind of stylistically the same, or like the Jurassic Park movies. You know, we have a director that we share our office with who, you know, tells us all that kind of behind the scenes politics stuff. But what do you think, Austin? I know that we talk about this a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember the death of the author is just one technology of interpretation. It's not the only way. So when I talk about death of the author anyway, I'm not being reductive in saying that that's all that matters and therefore intent doesn't matter. But the reason I think it's important to mention the death of the author is that so many people look at interpretation as being all about authorial intent. And this is where I think we can learn from the philosopher J.L. Austin, who developed something called speech act theory, where he makes a distinction between what's called the locutionary, the illocutionary, and the perlocutionary. So, and we can apply this to any piece of art. So the locution is like the words that are coming out of my mouth. The illocution is my intent. What am I trying to communicate right now? And the perlocutionary effects are the effects that it takes on outside of me that I don't really have control over, you know? I say the word fuck and someone's listening to this podcast without their headphones in, and then somebody hears it across the way, and then the person gets in trouble at work because, you know, you're not supposed to use that kind of language or whatever. So I think that we need to have a similar approach and recognize that all art, all film exists at multiple domains. It has the kind of just formal elements, the things that are actually on the screen and the noise that is coming out at us. And then at the same time, there's intent, but then there's also something more than that. And that's the level of the perlocution or the death of the author. And we need to kind of be able to navigate all of those together for a truly like robust criticism of any sort of film. But I think the reason that the death of the author is important is because so many people just think, ah, but this person was trying to say this. And unless we know the person and we're going to psychoanalyze them, it's really difficult to be able to decipher intention. And that's where death of the author is important.
Yeah, I'll just say that I think intention is important, and it's always things that we take into consideration. But at the end of the day, and I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast, I don't remember if it was this one or another one, the way I look at art analysis is just like looking at clouds. You know, you can look in the clouds and there could be a cloud shaped like a heart. Now, nobody shaped it into a heart. It just looks like one. And whether or not there was intention behind it, what matters is that it's a valid claim to say, hey, it's shaped like a heart. So,
I mean, if people are interested in this and for like a really crazy take on all of this, actually, my old advisor, supervisor, his guy named James Williams, he's a philosopher, and he wrote a book called The Philosophy of Signs. If you're interested in this sort of idea, because he develops what's called a process philosophy of signs. Or I think, I'm sorry, that's the name of the book, Process Philosophy of Signs. And he basically takes this idea to a whole other batshit crazy level. So if you're interested in exploring this even further, Process Philosophy of Signs, it's about how signs are always in a process of becoming, and that even like the death of the author isn't enough. You'd need to go even further. Damn. So just
awesome. You're so smart. Can I get like a top 10 reading list books to be a better black person? Like, you're one of those white people who are like, I feel bad being black. So, damn. He's like, did you read the new Ta-Nehisi Coates article? I was like, nah.
All right. You know, I was going to mention We Were 8 Years in Power, but I figured that'd be a bit over the top.
I'm going to get to cracking on that, by the way.
All right, guys, signing off. This has been Show Me the Meaning.
Show me the money!
See ya.
Peace.
Peace.
Later.